In association with NintendoWorldReport.com and Radio Free Nintendo, you're listening to Reset Button, NWR's first and only monthly column dedicated to dusty old games and the people who made them. This week, I'll be talking to Lewis Castle, a guy who you'll recognize as being one of the driving creative forces at Westwood Studios, before moving on to Electronic Arts, where he produced such games as the Lord of the Rings RTS and Boombox on the Wii. Today, though, we'll be talking with the Lion King on the Super Nintendo. I had a lot of fun with this interview, so I hope you'll enjoy it. With that said, here's me with Lewis Castle. How did you find yourself in the gaming industry?
Well, I got into gaming by starting with architecture, weirdly enough. I had a personal computer that I got as kind of a toy, and I was playing with it and such. And I got into architecture thinking that I would learn a lot more about computers to deal with drafting, electronic drafting. Mm-hmm. And what happened was I discovered kind of artwork on computers back then, of course, just a few colors, but very, very bright, solid fields of color that were really exciting to me as an artist. Mm-hmm. And so I started doing artwork on computers and, you know, converting the dots, putting them literally down on graph paper and converting them into hexadecimal and putting them in, and discovered, you know, had a program, obviously, to put those on the screen because there were no art programs at the time.
Right.
And just really loved it and had a great time with it. So the only way to be paid to do art on computers was to make art for games. So I started making art for games and kind of became passionate about programming games.
Wow. Yeah, that's cool. All right, so it's 1993, I assume, just before The Lion King enters development. And so where are you career-wise?
Wow, where am I career-wise in 1993? well, I've been doing it for 10 years,
okay.
I guess. Let me think about that. About that, 83, a little bit earlier, actually. I suppose I started right around... about 1982 or 80, even 81.
Mm-hmm.
Westwood started in 85, so by 93 we were 8 years into Westwood.
Right.
So doing quite well. We had just been bought in 92 by Virgin.
Mm-hmm.
So we would have been escalating our scale pretty quickly at that point.
Right.
I was the CFO, COO, and probably still the information guy, but I can't be sure about that. And of course, executive producing and producing games.
Right.
And so the guys over at Virgin said, "Hey, we've got this next movie from Disney to do." And I said, "Gee, that sounds cool, but they want to get it done in 6-7 months. That's awfully tight.
Wow.
It's not really the kind of games we've done." So it didn't seem like it was going to happen. And we met with the Disney folks and we talked about it. And the guy that was running the project said, "Well, before you say anything at all, come see the first 5 minutes of the film."
Mm-hmm.
Because my analysis was at the time, well, you know, animal movies with Disney, it hasn't really worked. You know, the people are the ones that, the princesses and peoples are the ones that always work the best.
Right.
So I was really kind of talking my way out of it. And then after I saw that first 5 minutes, I just said, "I got to do this."
Right. Yeah, I know.
This is such a powerful opening to a film. If the rest of it's anywhere close to this,
right,
you know, this is just a stunningly beautiful film. And not just an animated film, but just an incredible piece of work. And so, it hooked me. And I took kind of cherry picked about, I think it was 13 people out of our studio.
Mm-hmm.
And we started cramming on putting together a game engine that would be able to deliver a platformer with some 3D aspects and such. And,
So
it was pretty challenging.
I mean, the game is absolutely gorgeous.
No, thanks.
Yeah, I mean, it still holds up to this day really, really well. And, I mean, what was it like working with Disney on the Lion King license? I mean, did they have any strange or strict requests aside from just, you know, like a basic adherence to the source material?
So I guess actually it was really challenging, but, first because we were trying to do a simultaneous, or very close to simultaneous. Our game
right.
had to be at Nintendo in July. The movie was shipping in June, and Disney... really isn't, I don't believe, other than Disney software, of course, but
mm-hmm.
isn't in the habit of letting people behind the scenes while they're working on films.
Right.
Especially Jeffrey Katzenberg. His editorial process is such that he will just literally cut, you know, many, many chunks out of the film at any given time. So, So, you know, I remember there were just many sequences of the Simba returning from the, when he returns from the kind of hiatus he took with Pumbaa and Timon,
right,
and goes and doing all these adventures, and they were showing all this stuff on the board, and I remember so clearly Jeffrey Katzenberg was in the room there, and he's going through all that stuff, and he goes, explain to me how the story progresses from here to here, and of course got what everybody's kind of faffing about and talking about, and he goes, yeah, you're right, so you can't defend it either, let's just take all that out. And he just literally just took the entire chunk of film away.
But was Disney basically, were they pretty accommodating, though, as far as giving you all that access to the film and...
No, actually, that's what I'm saying, is that I guess the I was a long way of going about saying that it was very difficult to get access to anything. I mean, we only had 6 months to make the game, and I don't think we actually saw, you know, reasonably high-quality prints from the film until 3 months in.
Wow.
I mean, we were just speculating on so much stuff, it wasn't even funny. We were just scavenging for every little piece, every thread, every shred we could get. We had a basic plot outline,
uh-huh,
and we got some of their production stills, and it bit us a bit, because they gave us all these prints, and it was literally while I was down in Florida for 26 days, it was while I was there that they cut all these segments, and we had to argue strongly to keep them in the game. The whole waterfall sequence and things like that, if you've played through the game, all of that stuff was actually part of the movie, but it was intended to be part of the movie, but never made it.
Okay, wow, that's really interesting.
Yeah, so it was really interesting.
Yeah.
And then on top of all of that, the really difficult situation we were in, which I promised myself I'll never be in again, is Disney Film were the people who would approve the final work product of the game.
Uh-huh.
And they would be submitted by Disney Interactive to Disney Film. Disney Film would approve it. So the same group that we were contracting to do the cells were the people that had the approval over the game.
Wow.
And so we had to basically argue with our contractor all the time on how to properly create assets for the game, because if they weren't completely convinced that it was the right thing to do, they would just bounce it on the approval.
Okay.
And so it was sort of one of these weird things where we were paying them to create artwork for us, but they were the ones who get to decide whether or not the artwork is approved.
Wow, that's a really weird relationship.
Very, very strange. But on the flip side, it was worth
it.
It was painful, but it was worth it because Disney animators created all those cells. So
yeah,
we had to translate them, but they were beautiful. So.
And I mean, yeah, I think that's one of the reasons it probably holds up so well, is the art is just so amazing.
Yeah, the art of the game itself is credited to the very talented artists at Westwood that are credited on the game. There's Cindy Chin and mm-hmm. a bunch of folks that did some beautiful work for the game.
Absolutely.
The actual animation itself would never have come off as nicely as it did without Disney animators being the ones who created the original frames. That's mm-hmm. Clearly a skill and a talent that is just, they're some of the best in the world.
Mm-hmm. So then would you say then the hardest part of development was just dealing with the, I guess, approval process with Disney?
I think the hardest part of the development was getting, not an approval process, it was educating, you know, very talented, very passionate people of what was possible and what was appropriate for a game. The possible part, of course, came into, you know, when they would complain about the color, and I'm like, we don't have any other color. We could, you know,
right.
that's the only color green we got. Sorry. well, there was not quite that bad, but it was pretty bad at times, because they would send me back the, like the, what do they call the Pantone sheets, and say, well, you need to be more like this color instead of that color. I'm like, I don't have any control over that. And by the way, did you look at it on a different television set? Because it's going to be different.
Right.
You know, NTSC is never the same color, right? So, so there were some challenges there to educate. And then the game, what was appropriate was, it was really important that the animation pop. If you're jumping in midair and you turn directions, we have to be able to flip the lion around and have him go back the other way, because that's good gameplay.
Right.
And it was very difficult to explain to an animator that the laws of physics don't apply in games.
Mm-hmm.
You know, because they wanted to, they said, well, he should finish his leap and then he can turn around and jump back. And I go, no. It needs to respond immediately,
right,
or it won't be fun.
Yeah, the latency will kind of bounce it off and then it won't work right.
Yeah, it'd be terrible. I mean, if you jumped and, you know, halfway through your jump, you go, oh, crap, I don't want to jump, and you backed away, and it
exactly.
didn't turn around, that game would just be terrible. You'd never be playable.
Mm-hmm.
So I think that one of the other major challenges we had, too, was there was a couple of things that Disney had in place, because they were worried about the rental market. So they had this policy where the first percentage of the game had to take X amount of time to play, and it was completely mathematical and arbitrary. It really didn't have anything to do with reality, because they wanted to make sure that somebody couldn't get too far in the game, and their research told them that it was X percent. And I just said, you know, this is just really not the right way to approach it. You know, the game gets progressively more difficult, so just because you're halfway through the game doesn't mean you're halfway through the game. It means you're halfway through the levels, but you're nowhere near halfway through the game. Mm-hmm. And they made us, they really, really made us turn the screws on the player for specifically the second level, the monkey level. We had to make that really, really complicated because it was the only way to make people slow down enough so that they didn't chomp through the content.
Right.
And so I always regret decisions where you know that arbitrary kind of corporate decisions are going to impact gameplay. That one bugged us quite a bit. Other than that, though, I would say they were pretty easy to deal with, you know.
All right. Well, I mean, looking at your resume, you've got so many systems under your belt. You've worked on so many different architectures.
Oh, yeah. Virtually everything. I mean, the only reason that we were so well-suited for the Super Nintendo, by the way, was because we had worked on a platform called the Apple IIgs.
Right.
And the processor for the 2GS was the same as the Nintendo.
No kidding. Well, I was about to ask. Nintendo. I mean, what was it like developing on the Super Nintendo versus, you know, other contemporary systems?
Well, a lot of people thought we used the Virgin Shiny tools to do Lion King because it was a platformer, and of course Aladdin was such a brilliant platformer, but the reality was we didn't have access to any of that code or tools because those guys had left literally right before the Lion King started. So we had signed the deal, they announced they were leaving, and we were sort of left holding the bag. So we built all of our stuff off of the internal Westwood tools that had been written for the Apple IIgs. So actually, I think we have probably one of the most robust development environments of anybody on the Super Nintendo, because all of our tools were on another platform, and we ported the stuff over onto the Super Nintendo using some of our own technology.
I really wouldn't have guessed that you had done any porting. It's the game runs so smooth.
We didn't port any of the code. The code was all written for the Super Nintendo, but we actually took our libraries over and rewrote basically all the that's the tools, right? So a lot of the stuff that you want, like compilers and you know how you do your assembly and tracing and bug fixing and all that stuff.
Gotcha.
Having a target machine, having the actual development environment be on the Apple and the target machine be the Super Nintendo gives you a lot of power and a lot of flexibility. And most people just didn't have the kind of robust tools that we had.
Well, what was it like? We've heard so many stories of being a Nintendo licensee during the Nintendo and Super Nintendo era. What was that like as far as the relationship with Nintendo?
You know, we didn't. I would say we didn't get much static from them at all. But there was a reason for that. With 13 people, we simultaneously developed the game for the Super Nintendo and the Genesis and Sega Genesis, which is pretty an amazing feat even back then.
Definitely.
In six and a half months. Yeah. What we came down to is at the end, where most people get a lot of grief from both of these guys, both of them wanted to pack it in with their systems for Christmas, and there were some hard deadlines they had to make. So we would deliver code to them and say, okay, barring any egregious errors or egregious bugs, we've just submitted code to both of you. The first one to approve it is going to be the one, you know, if Nintendo bounces it and doesn't approve it, and Sega does, then we're just telling you up front it's going to be in Sega's pack-in for Christmas and not yours.
Right.
And at this point, The Lion King had just taken off as a franchise.
Oh, of course, yeah.
So this combination of the film just blowing through all the numbers and just being a huge success, and the idea that both of these companies desperately wanted to make sure it was on their system for Christmas forced them to be a lot more responsive and get right back to us on every single issue.
Right.
And then another thing that we weren't able to say at the time was we had actually written a lot of the Sega development tools for Sega, for the Sega Genesis. So again, we had a really great environment on the Super Nintendo. We also had a great environment on the Sega Genesis because we had written all their development tools, and those were supposed to be first party. We sold them to them outright, but we were, you know, nobody uses tools as good as the people who make them.
Right, of course, yeah. Well, it's funny that you bring up Sega, actually. I mean, developing the game on both systems concurrently, which would you say is the definitive version for you?
Between the two?
Yeah.
You know, I would say, with the exception of the Wildebeest level, I liked the Genesis controller better. It just I just always felt better to me.
It has a really nice mold.
Yeah, just for me. And I think it had to do with hand sizes, because my kids always loved the Super Nintendo so much better. And I just think that it just fit their hands better.
Right.
And I would say that except for that level was just so well done on the Super Nintendo. That was just a joy to play and a joy to write. We actually went into Disney and we had a a guy, I can't remember his name. His name was Ron, but I can't remember his last name now. But he was the technical director, and we had gotten this kind of the heads up from Disney internal that he was going to put the take the Wildebeest level and shoot it down because 3D on the Super Nintendo was, you know, unproven and too difficult and was going to slow down the process and everything else. So we literally scrambled and crammed to get that level fully functional before we went into review. Mm-hmm. And so we went in for a code review, gave them the whole code review of how we were going to do it. And of course, you know, immediately technical director from Disney goes, well, you know, my experience is this is going to be, you know, really hard to do and you can't do this, you can't do that. He said all this. And Patrick Gilmore and I said, we really appreciate all that feedback, and we were really concerned too, so we did it.
Right.
And we turned on the machine and showed them running. I was like, okay, well, a little hard to argue that it can't be done when it's sitting there in your face and it's working. So.
Definitely, yeah.
Yeah.
That's really cool.
Pretty cool. And, you know, it wasn't completely finished, but it was clearly workable. And you go, okay, yep, that's definitely going to be cool. We didn't have it on the Genesis, so we made ourselves a real problem because we had to go and do it on the Genesis with a lot harder.
Yeah, I'm sure.
But it worked on both game systems.
Great. Well, what was the reception to the game once it had come out?
Huge.
Obviously we know now, you know, it's really held up as, you know, Love the Lion King and Aladdin are kind of held up as this, you know.
Yeah, maybe the best that were ever done on the platforms as far as platformers go. Yeah, definitely.
I mean, even among, like, you know, licensed games, you know, of all time, really, like, you always hear about the Lion King, Aladdin, and then, you know, some of the other, like, Mickey Mouse games that came out around the same time, I think, that Capcom had worked on.
Yeah, I mean, the Mickey Mouse, the one with the forest, I can't think of the name of it, was so good.
Yeah.
Love to be in that company. I mean, it's just an honor, you know, to be there. But I think it was a really good game. We did a great job. It was a great team of people, both at Disney and at Westwood, of course. You know, I mean, I've had the fortune of being, attached to quite a few really successful licensed mm-hmm. games before. Monopoly was the best-selling Monopoly ever, still to this day, I believe,
really?
that Westwood did, for Monopoly for Windows, mm-hmm. and in 95, and then I would say Blade Runner, also highly recognized as one of the best uses of a license.
Definitely.
So I suppose that, you know, it's kind of in my DNA to, by the way, like, one of my favorite films of all, my favorite film of all time, Blade Runner, favorite animated film of all time to date is still The Lion King, you know, and my favorite board game growing up was Monopoly, so there's no surprise that those are the things.
It's a triple threat.
So, of course, I just, these are things, and I loved Dungeons & Dragons, too, and so those are... There's things that I was just so passionate about, and I didn't want to take away from the power and the glory of those licenses. I wanted to contribute to the body of art. And I think when you have people that are that passionately supportive of a franchise, mm-hmm. they just do a much better job. They translate their passion into love, and that it comes through.
So would you say then you have more of a, you have more of an attraction to licensed games versus original IPs?
No, most of my career I've done original IP. Those are literally the only ones I think I've ever done. We've done some D&D games, and then most, well, I gotta think about it. No, I mean, well, Lord of the Rings. We did Lord of the Rings. So, yeah, but otherwise, most of it's been original intellectual property. It's very rare that I've done licensed games, only about four or five. And then I think I did some, well, definitely did some Disney games early on too.
Right.
So not many. Most of my career has been original games.
Well, how would you compare, you know, your development process, you know, versus licensed games and original IPs? Would you say that you prefer one or the other, or do you think it's just kind of a different beast?
It's different, you know. I mean, one day I like oranges, the next day I like apples. I don't think I'd want to do only one.
Right.
I think that doing licensed games gives you a deep appreciation for the value of the backstory, the content, and the value of a property. So, if you go and create only original products and you've never had to work with somebody else's license, you tend to think of the product and the license as one thing. You don't think of them as a franchise.
Right.
So once you've done a franchise game and you realize there's people out there that care deeply about the quality of the franchise and the product, it puts you into a different mindset about what's, you know, how you should treat your own properties.
Mm-hmm.
So I think there's a real value to doing both.
Right.
And I can't say, you know, if somebody, people used to come to us all the time with all kinds of franchises, I used to analyze them and I'd say, okay, this one will make a good game, this one won't. We turned down franchises at Westwood all the time.
Right.
I mean, we were constantly being pitched. And most of the time, we would sit there and debate it, and we'd go, you know, we just don't see the great game in this. We can make a game of anything, but we just couldn't see the the, you know, the really powerful add to the brand kind of experience.
Right.
And sometimes we got it wrong. You know, somebody would do a game on a franchise and we go, wow, that was a great idea. I wish we had thought of that. I mean, we had pitched it and, or thought about it and passed on it. You know, then you find out somebody did a brilliant job and you kind of kick yourself.
Any of those that you care to bring up or?
I'm trying to think about it. I know that's happened. There was a Batman. There was a Batman thing. We just couldn't think of how to do a good Batman. Actually, until I saw Batman Arkham Asylum, I haven't seen a great Batman. That was just a phenomenal game.
Oh yeah, and, no, I still haven't played it, but I've been meaning to get to it.
What a phenomenal game!
It's on my,
just
it's on my
phenomenal.
List.
And so you say you look at something like that. You would have asked me the year before, would you do a Dark Knight game? I go, you know, I don't know. I don't know how you make a great one. So, Spider-Man. We passed on Spider-Man years earlier, and when they did Spider-Man, it's just a brilliant game. So much fun. I never imagined the web-slinging across the city would be so much fun. It was just a great mechanic. So a couple times, you know? I mean, we passed on even pitching. We didn't bother pitching it because we thought, how are you going to make a good game out of that? But I guess we were wrong.
It's funny that you bring up, you know, people, you know, passing on pitches. The last person that I did for this column in this podcast was Graham Devine. I don't know if you're familiar with Graham, but he actually...
Oh, yeah. He was at Virgin. He was the one who got us to join Virgin.
There you go, yeah.
His work and Rob Landeros' work on Seventh Guest was so impressive to us.
Oh, yeah, to completely...
Nobody had seen it. You see, nobody had seen Seventh Guest yet. We were looking at different publishers, and they came to us, and we looked at their stuff, and we said, wow, Virgin is really trying to change their name, because the products they had before that were not terribly good. Yeah.
Well,
and
it's funny, we were actually talking about his work on Silver Surfer for the NES, and he talks about how he was talking to Martin Alper, and they were talking about, Martin was saying that he wanted, you know, any license, he can get any license, Graham just says to pick the one he wants, and he turned down Graham's first two choices, which were, believe it or not, The Simpsons and Teenage Mutant Ninja Turtles.
Oh, wow. Yep.
So I guess,
but you know what? I wonder about The Simpsons because I've spent time talking to Matt Groening at various TED conferences, and I still believe that the great Simpson game hasn't been done yet.
You didn't care for the Konami game, the arcade game?
I didn't like the fighting one at all. Thought it was fine as a fighting game. It just didn't fit the franchise to me. So I believe that. Any interactive experience of a franchise should feel the same kind of emotions and feel the same kind of connectivity that I do to the franchise. Mm-hmm. So to have a Simpsons game without witty comedy, that doesn't make any sense to me.
Right. Okay.
Yeah, that doesn't mean that it's not a great fighting game. It just wasn't what I would think would be the perfect Simpsons experience.
Gotcha.
It's like if we went out to go to a South Park game, for instance, you'd have to have it be topical humor,
of course,
because that's what makes South Park funny. Is these kids that basically, I mean, honestly, it's the Peanuts, right? I mean, if you go back to Charles Schulz in a very, very clean and non-offensive way, but his whole approach to the Peanuts was to bring, you know, adult topics through the eyes of children,
right?
You know, and Linus would go off on some diatribe about something, and you go, wow, that's... There's no way a child speaks like that, but it's seeing it through their eyes that makes it so obvious.
And I mean, later on with like Calvin and Hobbes and such.
Calvin and Hobbes, I would say, if you didn't make a game about Calvin imagining his relationship with Hobbes, then...
Of course, it doesn't work.
Yeah, you couldn't make a game around him swinging a tiger and hitting people with it. Yeah. It doesn't make any sense.
Right. I don't think Bill Watterson would ever sign off on a Calvin and Hobbes game.
No, he wouldn't even sign off on books, for God's sake.
Well, moving up to something a little bit more current, I think your last game at Electronic Arts was Boombox, was it not?
Yeah, both of them, Boombox and Boombox Bash Party, yeah.
So what was it like working with Steven Spielberg, and what did he really bring to the table as far as, you know, from a development angle? I mean, was he really, like, down there in the trenches?
Well, the idea. Right? People ask me how involved was Steven. So the way that it was structured over at EA LA was every week Steven could stop by after dropping the kids off and visit with us for an hour or more. And that's how it was structured. And then, of course, his schedule wouldn't always allow for that. So we might have averaged two or three times. Well, maybe I would say about two times a month, I would guess. You know, there were months where we'd go 4 weeks and then months where we didn't see him. So I would probably say about every other week or so we would see him. And literally, I mean, what we would do is we would be working in between. We would present what we're doing. We'd tell him what's next, mm-hmm. and he would give us commentary. We would then filter his feedback, watch the tapes of him several times, giving us feedback to make sure we were addressing his concerns and issues,
right.
and then we'd put forth the gaming. And that started right in the beginning. The very first meeting I had was myself and Steven in a room for about 3 hours,
really?
Kicking around ideas on how to unlock the power of the Wii mm-hmm. remote.
No, I mean, Boom Blocks is, for me, like one of my favorite games from the last like few years.
Oh,
and,
great.
Glad
to hear
that. I was actually at PAX East about a month ago, and they have this, I don't know if you were there, but they had the this really big room set up as like a console free play room, and they list the top 10 games being rented, and Boom Blocks was, I think it was the second one, it was like the eighth. Because it lends itself so well to like a party environment.
Oh, yeah. That's Boom Blocks Bash Party was specifically designed to be the party game, you know, and then it was also for user-generated
right.
content. That was really important for us.
Mm.
So, I mean, actually, there's, I don't know how many, 40,000 levels or something ridiculous like
yeah,
that. There's just a huge number of levels out there. And the way the picker picks a level that's similar to the game you just played, I think, was really ingenious because mm-hmm. it made it so seamless. Our goal was really simple. Steven said, you know, he wanted to make a game for the Wii. He wanted to make something that was a little on the simpler side. And most importantly, he wanted something he could play with his kids and have a great time, and they would play it. And he could give to any of his friends, and they would enjoy it. So the original pitch was make a game with Steven Spielberg on a machine that you've never worked on, that EA doesn't really have a competency in,
right.
With a device that nobody's ever programmed for, to be attractive to audiences 8 to 80,
mm-hmm.
you know? And that felt challenging enough to go do.
I mean, it was funny, I was talking to a friend of mine earlier, and I mentioned that we were going to do this interview, and, you know, how I was going to bring up Boom Blocks, and he was very interested in, you know, obviously you think of Steven Spielberg working on a video game, you think it would be a very cinematic experience, and very, you know, it would feel
well.
More
and
like
and
a,
he and in fairness, he has been working quite some time with EA on that exact
on,
idea.
Exactly, yeah.
Yeah.
But what I was thinking was, the way that I kind of thought of it was that, you know, if he had a great idea for a story, he'd probably just go ahead and make a movie. You know, I think with Boom Blocks, he really had it was more about finding a very simple like gameplay mechanic.
No, that's an interesting perspective. I don't.
Would you agree with that?
I don't know. I mean, I guess what people miss is that Steven's magic to me is mm-hmm. he just understands people.
Mm-hmm.
He really knows what people like. He's got the best radar, filter, whatever you want to call it, mm-hmm. that I've ever seen. I would welcome him as a consultant on anything,
really?
And I mean anything. From if I was making a consumer device, a consumer, you know, electronic device, to a game, to, you know, shoot furniture, I'd ask his opinion. He's just, the guy is. I'm so privileged to have worked with him. He is just a genius. I mean, believe me, I'm not fawning over him because he's famous. I would say this if nobody knew who he was.
Right.
His instincts are just spot on. And so, to me, it was perfectly. I guess actually, originally when he said he wanted to make a game for the Wii, I was sitting there racing my mind, thinking, oh my God, how are we going to make a thing? But once I started talking to him and he was telling me what was exciting, it's clear he's a gamer
mm-hmm.
and he wanted to play a game. He wanted a game that would bring people together in front of the television set and make them
right.
feel like they were part of the family. Something that could balance itself depending on how difficult, you know, how expert the users were, so that people who weren't very good would enjoy it just as much as people who were very good. These are very hard things to do, and you need
right.
somebody with that kind of incredible, incredible compass, because
right.
otherwise, games that try to be everything to everybody usually don't end up being very much fun
anybody.
For anybody.
Exactly. Well, okay. Well, you know, again, getting to something a little more recent, what made you decide to leave Electronic Arts and join up with Garage Games and Instant Action?
Well, you know, I think it's pretty well publicized, but I'm happy to tell the story. I left EA prior to even knowing, honestly, what Instant Action was. I mean, I'd heard of Torque Tools, of course, and
right.
I really was interested in the free-to-play space, but for some reason I hadn't quite hit on their site.
Mm-hmm.
So I left EA because I had been working with Steven for several years. It was pretty clear that wasn't going to be something I was going to be able to do for the next chunk.
Right.
And I was holding out. I basically had exited the studio system for a while, and I was holding out for an opportunity that did not materialize,
uh-huh.
not due to anything their fault or my fault. And once I had disconnected myself from the day-to-day operations over at the studio, when push came to shove and several months had passed,
mm-hmm.
The opportunity didn't look to be getting any closer. And they gave me a very good opportunity to get back into the studio and start driving some projects. And I just said, you know, I'm really anxious and excited about doing something different. And it, not that it's not a wonderful opportunity. I can't say what it was, but it was a great opportunity. But I just go, you know, for anybody else in any other place in their career, they would be really excited about this. And I don't mean to be disrespectful, but it's just kind of done that. I just, I won't say been there, done that, but I've done similar things. And, you know, there wasn't that sense of excitement of working with a Steven, and there wasn't that, you know, kind of really difficult problem RTS onto console. I didn't have that kind of, it was basically make these games, great games, but yeah. So I just said, you know, yeah, it wasn't, they were definitely new elements. I'm not going to say it wasn't, but it was just, you know, it was like, if I'm just going to go make games, I can go do that kind of anywhere. And it just felt like it was time. I had managed to disconnect myself from the teams, which felt like I wasn't leaving anybody in a lurch. EA treated me very, very well. And I said, okay, well, I'll give you a couple weeks. They said, no, make it a little further. We really didn't come through with the job you have, so we'll take care of you on severance and all that, which they didn't have to do. So, I mean, they were just a really, really great. They treated me great the whole time I was with them, and I'll never say a bad thing about EA. You know, there's definitely its challenges in a big company, but the people are wonderful. The company treated me well. And it always comes across as genuine. You know, if you had me in a bar with a beer in my hand, I'd be saying the same thing. So then I left, and I was going to start a little company and start. I actually did start doing some consulting and stuff. And lo and behold, I get this call. They said, you know, boy, you really ought to. Somebody had passed on a job, and they said, if you don't talk to Lewis, you're being silly. You should talk to him. So they called me up. I flew out to New York to meet with IAC. I talked to them about what they had. I went up to Oregon to validate what they had. I'm like, really? And they said, yeah, this is what we got. So I went up there, took a look at it, met Josh Williams, the current. He had stepped down as CEO, but the former CEO, and Andy Yang. And I was just, I got to tell you, I was so blown away by how compelling it was to watch full-fledged games running seamlessly in a browser. And to me, that just opened my eyes. I'm like, oh my God, this is how we should be distributing games. We are, you know, it just made it so painfully obvious to me that we've just got it wrong, and that we need to build it because nobody's built it yet, which is the right delivery mechanism for interactive entertainment. And I'm sure we'll get copied. Yeah, I'm sure we'll get copied. I'm sure we'll get knocked off, but that's okay. That's good in a way. I'm a game maker at heart. I don't mind building something that will help us take games to a new method of distribution, a new way of monetizing, and then turn around and use it to make my own games. That's fantastic. That's good for me. So
yeah, I mean, if people are copying it, that means it's working.
Yeah, and I mean, they're certainly copying our messaging right now, but I don't think anybody quite has exactly what we've got yet. I guess the way of summing it up is the way games need to be, right? The way it must be eventually, and I'd say this is true of all media, is at least media on the internet, is it must be findable or discoverable anywhere.
Right.
So the first and foremost thing you got to fix is embedding.
Right.
And so our technology allows you to embed games, and to my knowledge, nobody other than the thin client guys allow that. And it has to be accessible by anybody. And so that then writes out the thin client guys, because, well, in the case of OnLive, you've got to subscribe. In the case of the other ones, they'll be very good for people that have low latency, high bandwidth, but otherwise you're going to have a tough time. So so you need a solution that does a downloadable, you know, very quickly downloadable if you can't do the thin client. And then on top of that, so they have to be, it has to be shareable, it has to be discoverable, it has to be free. Really important that finding it and playing it is free first, because that's what people come to expect of media on the internet. And it's really hard for people to get their heads around it, but it's critical in my opinion. It must be the real free, not the $15 a month free, but the real free. You know? Then once it's free, then you have the opportunity to incrementally charge for premium or premium content or continued play. And it needs to be incremental. Now, we our first title, for lots of reasons, is a low price point, not incremental. But clearly, that is what must happen, and that is what we hope to do with newer titles as we start to launch them. So once you have all of those components, you've changed the way that people experience media on the internet right now, at least games, because right now you have to go to some place, you have to download something that takes some amount of time, usually a long time. You then have to install it, and then after installing it, you then get to play it. And meanwhile, you had to pay up front for that privilege. So you put people through an awful lot of pain before they get to play, and they have to have made the decision to play before they've even seen it. It's just not the way that people are going to consume media in the future.
Well, it's interesting that you bring that up. I was actually I was watching a video interview with Jason Rubin recently, and it seems like he has a similar idea where he's looking at the Korean MMO model, which is, you know, free to play, and then once you, you know, basically if you want other items or if you want to access certain content, you have to pay for it.
Right.
And do you really think that, like, that's where we're going to be going as a medium?
I think that's a way. And I think that what's brilliant about that is it matches all the things I just said, right? The only problem is that most MMOs that I see, you have to go to a site, and even if you go to a Facebook page, it's just a link to a site, and it takes you away. And I guess my gut instinct is that over time, each person that uses digital media distribution will have preferred filters that they use.
Mm-hmm.
Maybe I'm casting too much of my own behavior, but I see way more people with the Huffington Post, Daily Beast, and places like that to find what they want, or Wimp, Big.
Right.
So what does that really say about the future of the internet? I think, and I'm kind of crystal balling here a little bit, that's always dangerous, but I think it means that the idea that I would search for a game, having read about it or seen about it somewhere, go to a place and then download some piece of it to play it, feels as alien to me in the future as the idea that I would get in a car and go to the store to buy media.
Right.
I mean, it's like, why would I do that? Mm-hmm. Why would I have to leave my house? Why don't I just turn it on? Right. And that's really, I think, so not that I would discount what Jason's saying. I think he's got the right elements, but I think that distribution method of come to our site, not likely in the future. And I don't think that, with the exception of maybe dedicated devices with apps, I don't think that you're going to see, and even then, those are getting pretty ugly. I mean, because you've just got pages and pages and pages of apps.
I don't think
people are going to have icons on desktops. I think they go to their portal, and the things that they like are embedded in their portal, and it's their portal. It's not somebody else's portal.
Well, it's interesting that you bring up apps, because I think, you know, as, you know, hopefully if tablets take off as, you know, a legitimate corner of the PC market, at least more than they are now, I think you're going to be seeing, you know, you're talking about devices that are not the bleeding edge, definitely not from a storage standpoint. So I think, you know, if people have these iPads or, you know, one of these other devices that are coming out soon, you know, they're going to want gaming because you finally have a screen large enough where, you know, you're not straining your eyes just to see it. So I think it's going to be interesting to see what sort of business plans come out as far as gaming for that kind of platform.
iPads also got a little bit more powerful engine in it and everything else too, which is important, and in a long battery life. Yeah, I mean, honestly, I find myself using the iPad a lot more than I thought I would. This is way off the topic of Lion King, but yeah, I mean, I got one as a gift from Barry Diller, sent one to all the CEOs of his companies, and so I got one as a gift, and I think his note was really great. It said the next great thing, or maybe not, or something. Like that. But it was really very telling in the sense that, you know, you should know about this.
Right.
You should try it. And so I kindly just said, oh, okay, fine. I plugged it in, synced it, and did all that.
Definitely.
And, you know, surprisingly, it's sitting here right on my desk, and I've been carrying it around with me at this conference I'm at. And I got to tell you, it does most everything I want to do with my laptop and most everything I want to do with my phone. I still carry my phone for phone calls and text messaging-ish. You know, and I think if I had a decent text messenger, I probably would even use the iPad for that.
Mm-hmm.
But otherwise, I mean, it's kind of great. And I could easily see myself taking a trip and just bringing my iPad.
Yeah, it's really appealing to me. I haven't made the jump yet. I think I'm waiting for the second generation. But, yeah, no, I mean...
I got to tell you, the Wi-Fi, I mean, even though it's first generation, I mean, it works great.
You know? I've been burned before by Apple first generation. You know, I got the first of the MacBooks, which, don't get me wrong, I'm using it right now. I love it. But, you know, it's starting to show its age, especially when you consider what came out afterwards. So, you know, I'm considering going, you know, iPad and then iMac and then having that be my computing solution. I don't know. I haven't decided yet. I'm. It's going to be hard to tear me away from a MacBook Pro. I don't know. I haven't decided yet.
I love my MacBook Pro, and I don't think I'd ever give up my MacBook Pro for a lot of reasons, because I like the real keyboard and all the other things. But I think to believe that it's going to replace a laptop is incorrect, and to believe that it's going to replace an iPhone is incorrect. Now, it might have replaced your iPad Touch, but even then, maybe. That's a much more portable device. This is not as portable as a phone, obviously.
Right.
So I think it ends up being, I think the reason it's exciting is when you really start to play with it, you start to realize you're not using it for the things you thought you were.
Right.
In fact, actually, one of the things I thought I'd use a lot for is browsing, and not really, mm-hmm. because the lack of being able to play Flash makes it just kind of a crappy browser.
Yeah.
So it's not really good at that. It's okay at it, but it's mm-hmm. not great. It's much better as a media consumption device.
Right.
So, interesting.
And on that odd tangent, I think we'll close up the interview.
Sure.
Well, thank you so much for talking with us. I really appreciate it. I know that the listeners and readers for the feature are really going to appreciate it. You know, The Lion King is... I was talking to the other guys on staff, and they're all really excited to hear it because they're all huge fans of the game. Again, thank you so much for taking the time out. I really appreciate it.
That's my pleasure. Thank you.
All right, have a good one.
Take care. Bye-bye.
Bye.
And that wraps up this month's Reset Button on The Lion King. I had a blast talking with Lewis, so a definite kudos goes out to the folks at Instant Action for hooking that up. Head on over to instantaction.com to check out what they're up to. Of course, a big thanks has to go out to Lewis for taking some time out of his insanely busy schedule to talk shop about one of his old projects. And I hope you enjoyed it too. Alrighty guys, that's it for Reset Button in May. See you in June for more.